You think you're over it? Wanting another title?
No. I want one, bad. But some days, I wish I'd have been like you through this. Look, I wanted to win in spite of Donald. Overcome. But we couldn't. Maybe we should have boycotted. Maybe we should have shown people that we were hit too hard to play.
Hi, I'm Ramona Shelburne, and you're listening to Let's Talk Clipped. Today, we're talking about the sixth and final episode of Clipped, Keep Smiling. In this episode, Shelly looks for a buyer for the Clippers. Donald takes Shelly to court. V makes her last stand. And Doc and the players try to process the end of their season. Our guests today are returning from our very first episode to help us wrap this all up. Showrunner Gina Welsh and producer Rembert Brown, who actually wrote this episode together. Gina and Rembert, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Ramona Shelburne.
Hi, Ramona.
We have reached the end of the road. The final episode has now aired. Your show, Gina Welsh, Rembert Brown, is a wrap.
It's cool.
How's that feel?
Well, we've had many wraps. No, it feels great to have it, you know, have it out there for people to receive and enjoy. It's awesome.
Yeah, I think making something is very exciting and nerve-wracking and, you know, you hope people like it, but you also, like, stand by the thing you made. So to get to the end, it's very, it feels great. Just feels great.
I mean, one thing I'll say about it, because, like, when you actually finish post-production on the show, everybody you talk to is like, how are you? How do you feel? And the truth is that making this show with the community of people who worked on it was so rewarding, and I think we're all so proud of it, that, you know, we just let it go in the end.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, that was the reward, was making the show together.
Yeah.
It's great.
You know, I always feel really nostalgic when we get to the end of things. Like, I've been like that since I was a little kid.
It's like summer camp. It's like the last day of summer camp. It's like, oh, like, that's how I felt the last day we shot.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, wow, like, I appreciate so many people. And I also, you know, being my first show, like, really understand how many people it takes to do this well and how much trust is required to do it well. So, yeah, it feels great.
Should we, like, pop a bottle or something?
Yeah!
I know you've done that, but, like, I don't really know how to pop a bottle.
Well, Ramona, I have 8 years of fine dining waitress experience under my belt, and I would be... I would love to tell you about our specials.
Tell me.
Yeah.
Tonight we have a glazed porcini mushroom.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's actually been a while since I've done this, and I usually do it with a fine linen.
Should I get out the way?
Over the top? No, ma'am. You're working with a professional.
Should we saber it in the studio?
While, watch out, Rem.
Is there a sword?
Where are you folks visiting from tonight?
Wow.
Hey! Oh!
That usually doesn't happen. Someone shook it.
We got some glasses, though. This podcast will be a lot better if we all drink a little.
Fully covered in.
Can we get a napkin?
Okay,
maybe a towel. Let's not use your sweater.
The amount of liquid that's now on my shirt and pants.
Is it really all over you?
Yes.
Can we get her I'm never gonna
get a restaurant job again.
Yeah.
By the way, you didn't even shout out your restaurant. What restaurant?
I worked at Jardiniere in San Francisco.
Oh.
Which is, we have a fake Jardiniere in the show.
I know. That's why that popped for me when you said it.
Let's go to dinner.
All right. We're gonna get some champagne here. Thanks, Rem.
Of course. But this pouring is very, like, veteran.
Cheers to you guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
There's a plastic clank. Mm. Oh, yeah. Let's talk.
We're drinking on the job.
Let's talk.
Let's go. All right, guys. How did it feel trying to make this last episode and wrap up all the storylines? Did you feel like every character got the ending they deserved?
Well, there was a storytelling challenge in this episode, which is that the tonnage of story for the Sterlings was huge. And the amount of story that we had for Doc and for the Clippers was sort of, there was less story available. So we had to sort of manipulate the timelines a little bit in order to make that work. And then we also decided in the writer's room to make a choice that we had to sort of fight for again and again, which was to hold V out of view, because we wanted the show to capture the feeling that happened in the real world, which is that basically V's 15 minutes was over and that our other characters had forgotten about her. So mm-hmm. what we were encountering when we were getting notes from producers and from the network was, we miss her, we miss her. And we were all like, that's the point. You know, you really have this emotional connection to that character and you want to get back with her. And I think the thing that was really important to us in the finale, after this sort of false happy ending of episode 5, was to really live into what was happening after the sort of media firestorm around the tape moved on and the story became about power reasserting itself and what that felt like for the characters on whom this happy ending had been stuck.
Yeah, I love the way we ended it. I think, you know, ending it with Doc and Elgin was something that we didn't want to lose and had lots of conversations about, because I think in order to understand the story, even though Elgin is not one of our lead characters, like, his presence is so important to understand Doc, to understand these other Black players and what they were wrestling with. So just to end the show with that, Elgin, someone who had been reluctant to even come back to the court, you know, this place was like a curse hung over him. But yeah, just to see Doc at the end, he's still trying to figure it out.
But I'm looking beyond all this now, Elgin. I'm looking.
Well, this world will hit you again. And you still young enough to hit back.
You showing off now.
I need to shoot till it sounds right.
Dark.
And by the way, we worked on the exact timing of that cut to black and the swish for quite some time.
This episode was co-written by Rembert Brown and Gina Welsh. How was that collaboration?
It's awesome.
It was great. I felt really fortunate to have a partner in this. I felt like just as an individual, my writing improved over the course of the year and a half that, you know, from the writer's room to actually working on the episode. So in terms of, like, when I watch it now, like, I feel a lot of myself and the things that a lot of these characters are saying. And, you know, I love working with Gina. Like, I really valued just, like, the entire experience, but actually, like, digging in, working through notes, it's why I write. I like to work on it and work and work and work. So I loved it.
Yeah, and we were really lucky to be writing the finale as we were shooting, which was pretty punishing, just because the demands of production were intense. But what was great about it was that we were also responding to what we were seeing between the characters, and we were writing toward things we were getting from the actors. But there were always things in that episode that belonged to Rem that he found in the room. So we had had a problem in the room in terms of figuring out, like, what is the right place to leave the players after, you know, this devastating loss? Do you want to leave it hanging there?
If we hadn't played, if we had shut everything down, maybe we could have made it more than about Donna.
We made best possible decision in impossible circumstances.
Doc, I wish you'd let us stay mad.
And we worked on that scene between Chris and Doc and sort of imagined trying to tell the story of a generational shift and trying to tell the story of what's going to happen in the subsequent year, mm-hmm. where sort of the player empowerment era comes about. But we felt like we needed some moment of reflection and hope with the players too. And Rem was like, well, Jamal Crawford had like a bachelor party that summer and like all the guys were there and like, you know, yeah. And they did a midnight game in Seattle.
This don't look like a strip club to me.
Is this a high school?
What are all these little hoopers doing here?
Man, you want us to play drunk?
Hey, it's a midnight game. Sober up for the young, impressionable children, fellas.
What was so great when we were going through the post-production process, we brought in all of the actors who play players to come and do ADR for that scene. And so they all got to see it. And it was like that scene meant so much to those actors.
Yeah.
Like, I think they really felt like it was the perfect endpoint for them as a crew. And it just wouldn't have been there without Rem. I mean, he sort of found that moment.
I think one of the most powerful scenes in the final episode is between Doc and LeVar, where they trade stories about the reminders of racism in their homes. For Doc, it's Muhammad Ali's gloves that were saved from his house that was burnt down in a hate crime. And for LeVar, it's the chains he wore when he was filming Roots.
I keep my chains on the wall in the living room. I want my guests to know, while I am unquestionably their friend, I am also absolutely filled with rage.
Is the story about the chains on LeVar Burton's mantle true?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Real story. That's like, this is like LeVar Burton. Yeah. Like, this is like real LeVar.
Like, and he also, I mean, he's funny about it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this is true for the whole show, but especially in the moments we get Doc and LeVar, but as we were coming up with it, and then once we saw it when we were shooting this thing, I couldn't stop thinking about, there's not a ton of examples of just like having two black people talk to each other about what it's like to be black. You know, a lot of times it's like one black person explaining it, you know, to the masses, but to see the dialogue and to just watch how they were bouncing off of each other, and that's just like a real conversation that I think we were really privileged. Like, it was helpful that Lawrence Fishburne and LeVar like really see each other as peers, you know, and the amount of respect outside of the role, I really feel like came through in the way that they like really created magic every time they were together. There would be moments when I was like watching the two of them, and probably more than everything, it felt like very overwhelming to me. I'm like, I can't believe that LeVar Burton and Lawrence Fishburne are doing this. And it feels really beautiful, especially like LeVar leaning in and being the rawest that the public has ever heard him talk. And it's not like LeVar as playing someone else. This is like, we're getting LeVar Burton's like testimony in this throughout the show, which I love.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the decision to show LeVar and Doc's rage throughout that scene, which is a pretty quiet scene, but you feel their rage.
Yeah.
You know, when I first had a meeting with LeVar about the show, and at that point, I think he'd read the first two scripts. Mm-hmm. He told me that he would do the show as long as he could talk about his rage.
Once I read Go the Fuck to Sleep for charity, one of my brand partners dropped me.
What, you can't even say fuck?
I can, but there are consequences. I said fuck. I lost money.
Shit.
If I showed how angry I really am, but I'm not gonna hide it.
The fact that he had rage that he'd never figured out how to show, you know, in any of his sort of public personae, that he felt like he needed to. And I was like, yeah, that's part of the show. And it's revelatory. And I think the reason that we decided to use that story that Doc tells about the hate crime and the fire that burned down his family home, which is a story he's told in the press and, you know, a story that he shared when we interviewed him, is, to me, that story and Doc's response to it, that he wanted his home leveled to a white slab before his family came home and he wanted to move on. He did not want to go after the arsonists. To me, that choice makes legible what he's trying to do with the team when the Sterling tape comes out, which is, let's just try to keep our heads down and get through this and then prove that it could not slow us down.
Yeah.
You know?
When Donald's tape first came out, I felt like, let's move on. Don't look back. Don't get dragged down by shit that you can't change. I did not want us to stay angry.
So to me, that's why that conversation belongs there. And the storytelling that LeVar does in response to that is like, no, you need to put your chains on the wall. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. I also think the, you know, LeVar getting into that idea of like people thinking that he's safe is like a really interesting thing to come out of this show. It's like people think of you one way and they don't ever want you to show a different side because they fell in love with this version of you. So how dare you betray us? Like, that's what LeVar is getting off of his chest. Like, there's so many things that are so much bigger than basketball. I know people who have just, you know, work in every industry who have felt the moment they decide to speak up, suddenly they're out of the inner circle. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't get the same stuff anymore because people like, oh, you're a radical, blah, blah, blah. So there's so much about that scene that I was really happy that we got out.
There's another scene with Doc where you get to feel a bit of his rage or his feelings towards the Sterlings or the situation he's just lived through. And that's when Doc and his son confront Shelley after lunch about how she seemed to emerge from the scandal even better off.
Well, I was looking at our financials. You still have 12 tickets for every game, VIP passes, free food, free parking. If we win a title, you get 3 championship rings. Why 3? I have no fucking idea. You are officially the team's number one fan, and that's codified in your deal, and you and Donald still own our practice space, which means you'll probably just keep taking our rent money.
What went into planning that scene, and why is it so important?
That was a sort of a fictionalized moment that, you know, that confrontation didn't happen. But it felt like in our conversations with Doc that that was sort of an element of how he sort of felt about the math that all got worked out after the scandal. And we felt, just in terms of Doc's character journey in the show, that it was really important to give the satisfaction of hearing him say it all, you know, and to have, you know, that confrontation with Shelley, especially after episode 3, when she was coming to the stadium, he's like, she hasn't done anything wrong. Be nice to her. She's going through a hard time. And then she shows up on the team bus. Narratively, we really felt like we needed some justice for his character in that confrontation and for it to be kind of a plain statement of fact. This is all that you got, you know, out of the deal. So you didn't really give it up, you know?
And to say it in front of his son, that adds like an extra element. Like comparing that, you know, Doc and Chris almost have like a father-son-ish moment where it's like, I look up to you, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, to see him actually do that in front of his son, it felt like it helped Doc, like, stand up a little bit more straight as he goes into whatever comes next.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power, so how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and, of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/30for30. That's oracle.com/30for30. oracle.com/30for30.
So one of the more powerful scenes is when Justine goes to Shelley and says she's disappointed that she's not getting divorced after all this, because that was sort of the basis of their relationship and their friendship.
All these years, I've thought that maybe you had Stockholm Syndrome because you married Donald so young. I thought
Maybe you were serious when you were waving your divorce papers at Barbara Walters. I mean, no one would possibly do that as a stunt. I thought maybe you were finally waking up, but you were never asleep. And you're not divorcing Donald. You two were made for each other.
She seems kind of like a conduit for the audience in the way she expresses her feelings towards that. How did you think about her character while you were writing her?
Well, we always imagine Justine, and this was the great thing about that actress, Harriet Hanson Harris, who's been
so
a character actress
incredible.
Forever. I mean, she showed up to set with like a full character history for Justine. She's like, she has gotten her PhD in art history, but she doesn't use it. And, you know, and I was like, wow, you've really gone deep. And she said, you know, I never know when I come to set if I'm going to have someone to talk to about my character. And so I always do a lot of character work before I arrive. And what we had thought of for Justine, I mean, I think her character description in parentheticals in the script was a little bit psychic. In quotes. And so we sort of imagined her as someone who was probably had a life that looked a lot like Shelley's life until her divorce. And after her divorce, she stayed single. She had no money. She decided to make jewelry. But we wanted her to feel like sort of a slightly new age Malibu woman who still hung out with a pretty conservative crowd. And I think her character really wants to believe that Shelley is on the cusp of making the kind of life change that she made herself, and that she sees in Shelley a woman who has put up with a lot of shit for a really long time and who has tried to cover for her husband, but who is not similar to him.
You know, I love what she said. Once Doc leaves, she gets that last jab.
Nice to meet you, Justine. Come on, son.
You don't own him.
That also feels like a powerful moment for Justine, then, who's kind of been this like sidekicky character the whole show.
Okay, so we do eventually get to see a bit more of Miss Stiviano.
Yes,
because V and the Sterlings go to court over the gifts that Donald gave her. She is wearing a light pink pantsuit. How does this look differ from the V we met in the beginning of the series?
Oh, well, it's such a transformation, you know. Kate Adair, our costume designer, did such a beautiful job of both, you know, matching the real life looks, but also sort of bringing in all of these great details and tailoring them for Cleo. And we have this naturally occurring character arc in what V was actually wearing through this period, where in the pilot, in the second episode, she's looking for any kind of attention. Maybe she's looking for negative attention. You know, it's a lot of reds and greens, mm-hmm. a lot of flash. And then toward the end of the show, with the white pantsuit and the pink suit, there's a softness and an innocence and a femininity that comes in. But what I sort of love in that scene where she has to get stopped as she's coming into court is we've got the same white Hermes handbag that she's showing off in front of Shelley.
Yeah.
The white Hermes handbag, it travels across the entire character arc.
I didn't even catch that until you just said it. Yeah. So the courtroom scene, I think, is electric, the way you guys wrote this. V's watching Shelley hold Donald's hand in slow motion and knowing right then it was already over. How did you give this scene the emotional punch that it has?
Well, it's interesting because when we wrote the script, we didn't actually intend to shoot the scene in court. Because I think for us, just the image of the Sterlings holding hands told the story. And, you know, as you know, Ramona, the actual proceedings in court are much more complicated and insane. But what I think felt right to us was to essentialize that moment down to V telling the courtroom, I worked for him, which is what we've seen.
Yeah.
It's a weird job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a weird job. But she did work for him. She waited for him outside the dentist's office. She talks to the fucking Red Bull guy. She works for him.
She works for him.
And for the Sterlings to say she's a grifter, which was the essence of what was going on in court.
Because in Mr. Sterling's sworn deposition, He says, and I quote, "The cars are mine. I put them in her name because of her criminal record." I quote, "She was an indigent on welfare. If she killed somebody, I didn't want to be liable."
So we really boiled it down to that moment and the betrayal and the racist stereotyping of Donald submitting a statement saying she was an indigent on welfare, and if she hit somebody, I didn't want to be liable, which is why I put the cars in her name. So that final turn where he and Shelley and Pierce have sort of conspired to put this racist stereotype of her on the record in order to reclaim her things felt to me like the important moment to nail in the courtroom.
Yeah, we've seen Donald be nasty the whole show, but maybe it's from where we see V in the beginning of that scene where, like, she's got her outfit on and she doesn't think Donald's coming. Like, once you see him, you kind of get the feeling of where it's going. But to hear him say that, which kind of tracks from racist, nasty things he said about other women who he's been in court with over the years, it's like a clear conspiracy. It's like, well, this is how we keep our power. Mm-hmm. In some ways, you'll do anything. Like, that's kind of what we get from the Sterlings.
Okay. The other scene, and this is an incredible ending that you wrote for Donald, in this incredible bit of timing, the Ferguson protests were happening at the same time the NBA had to confront racism. Tell us about the decision to have Donald Sterling, played by Ed O'Neill, sunbathing naked while reading about that. What does that scene say about Donald's view of the world?
Well, first it says Ed is game. Like, that's like the
before we get into Ferguson. I think he just was so game. Yeah. So anyway, I think one of the things that we really wrestled with for a long time was, obviously, this is a story about an Obama era racial reckoning.
Yeah.
And toward the end of the show, we're headed into the summer where Michael Brown was murdered, the summer where Eric Garner was murdered. And so how could we have the show carry that without it feeling like glib or slight, or like we weren't trying to feel the full weight of that? Because really, I think part of the function of indicating that we're heading into that era is to say, well, this racial reckoning, what did it change? You know, we were trying to figure out a place to do it and to feel sort of the fires of it in the LA Times, but to have the Sterlings basically use the paper to, you know, as sort of a sun guard felt about right.
Yeah, and, you know, Shelley giving the, like, oh, that's just, like, so terrible. It feels so distant and so just, mm-hmm. like, that's something happening over there, which I think is how people in power often feel about, you know, the ills of the world. It has nothing to do with my life. But yeah, I went to Ferguson and I covered it, and I remember that were coming up in newspapers. They were so in your face. And so, like, if you don't believe in it now, like, what else can we do? And, you know, there's so much about the show that is, like, it's about what happened in the moment, but it's also really showing where America's headed. Mm. I think of 2013, which is the first year of Obama's second term, is pretty much like as good as it got. Mm. Like, we were post-recession, Obama was cooking, everyone was happy. There were like rappers in the White House every week. It was just like a really fun, happy time to be an American in some ways. And by 2014, all hell breaks loose, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. to think that we've kind of been in like 10 years of this, to have that image, it's about what was happening then, but also like giving a glimpse into what's coming next.
Yeah.
We have come to the end of the road, guys. The part where we get to reflect on the series as a whole, on the real life events as a whole, and you as the first authors of history have probably thought about this a lot and what you want people to take from the show, whether it's from Doc, from Shelley, from V, from the whole situation at large. What do you, Rembert, want viewers to think about and take from the series?
My answer would be like one of my own takeaways, like something I've taken away from having my head in this world for a couple years is like the idea of like, what's the worst that can happen if you stand up against power and injustice? You know, like I think something we get to at the end is this idea of Chris saying, I wish you would have let us stay mad. This idea of Doc's idea is like, you can do all that, but you gotta win. But then if you don't win, it falls very flat. And so, again, thinking about how a lot of the themes of this show apply to real life, I think that's one of the takeaways that I would want someone to think about in terms of their own life is like, I understand all the fear that comes, and some of that fear is reputational, some of that fear is maybe future access to things. But if you're like, well, I wonder what happens if they just shut it down, like, do they become exiled? Like, probably not. What probably happens is a reckoning might have to happen. And some of the themes that we clearly cared about in the show, this idea of the struggle between wanting to stand up, but also being really concerned about your job and your reputation and all this other stuff is something that I think after watching the show, some people will think about how they exist in their own lives. It makes me really happy that that is something that came through, because that's something that I have spent my entire adulthood trying to find the balance of, when is it time to say I don't give a fuck. So that's something that I'm really proud of for the show, of just like trying to unpack that and not really coming down on one side, but just showing all the things that can happen from an incident like this.
I really love the answer.
Me too.
I
was like, that was really good.
Yeah, that's really great.
Second champagne.
God, you just get better with champagne. Than worse.
I said that at the top.
You did. Is there a point at which, though, you start to fall apart?
The end of two.
Oh, the end.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of two.
I get a little burpy after a while. It's a lot of bubbles. I actually can't answer that question, because I feel very profoundly that we put all of our ideas into the show, and I can't prescribe how any viewer feels about it.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to take it on the terms that they watch it, you know? And that's what it's made for. It's made for people to disagree about it and really just to want to talk to each other about it. I don't have an answer for that.
I think Rem's answer actually got me thinking about this idea that the show is a limited series, right? There's six episodes, there's a beginning, there's whatever decision you want to make about where it should end or what period of time it covers. But it really is a precursor to a reckoning that we have in the NBA and in the world at large.
An internet reckoning, just like the power of, there's so many things that were in kind of like infancy stages that soon after this just fully exploded. And I think this incident can sometimes get lost in all of the other racial power reckonings that happened. But when you think about when it happened, it's very critical moment with regards to all of the things that kind of happened during that time period, especially in 2014 to 2016. I think a lot of the country thought we were past this, and then we realized that we were just like back in it in a way that some people couldn't believe. And something that I think the show does well is like, this is what 2014 was like. You know, this is how, even down to just like how, you know, stuff traveled online and, you know, seeing the memes and stuff like that. Like, there's so much about 2014 which was showing where we were headed.
I think 2014 and this story and the scandal kind of represents one of these lines of demarcation for me. Wherever you want to choose to start telling the history of the player empowerment era in the NBA, whether it's the Miami Heat wearing the hoodies after Trayvon Martin, whether it's this, whether it's LeBron, you can go all the way back to 2010 and his decision. You can start telling that story in any of those spots. But I think this is as good a place as any, because I'll never forget where I was when LeBron James steps in front of the microphone and says, there's no place for Donald Sterling in this league. Mm-hmm. That is a pretty profound statement and moment. And I think you guys do an incredible job of getting us to that point in the NBA, but also in society. And I know it's limited series, but there's a lot more story to tell that comes after this. And I think that's why I'm happy we left off where it does, because, oh, you never know. Maybe there's more. Gina, Rembert, thank you so much for all your time, your thoughts, your reflections, and your great work on this.
Ramona, thank you.
Thank you, Ramona. Thank you for all of your great reporting on the podcast and, you know, just making the show with us.
This episode was hosted by Ramona Shelburne and produced by Megan Coyle. Our associate producer is Gus Navarro. Our line producer is Kat Sankey. Sound design by Ryan Ross Smith and Sean Howard, and original music by Hannes Brown. Preeti Varathan is our head of audio. Our head of development is Kati Fernandez. Our head of talent relations is Chantre Kamak. Our executive producers for 30 for 30 and ESPN Films are Marsha Cook, Brian Lockhart, Burke Magnus, and Heather Anderson. Our ESPN audio team includes Megan Judge and Devin McGowan. Special thanks to Rosalind Bibby at FX and Greg Bergman at ESPN LA Radio. As always, thank you for listening.